Okay, so let us carry on. And we had just been looking at the idea of two kinds of thoughts. And on the one hand, we have the unwholesome thoughts that are not helpful on the path. And then we have the other side, which are the thoughts that are helpful. And we're going to look a little bit more at the idea of sensual pleasures, or if you like, the five sense world. And so this session will continue on that. And the idea, the reason why I focus so much on this is that if you want to have success in your meditation practice, this is kind of the one area which is really important and really matters enormously. And you may remember, you may recall, if you think about the five hindrances to meditation, and the five hindrances are always, they always occur in one particular order. It always starts off with karma chanda. Karma chanda is chanda is desire, and karma is the five sense world. So it always starts off with desire for the five sense world. That's always the number one hindrance. And then you have vyapada after that, which is ill will. Then you have tinamida, which is lethargy and tiredness. And you have udita kukucha, restlessness and remorse. And the last one, vichikicca, which is doubt. These are the five hindrances. But it always comes with the karma chanda, the desire for the five sense world, is always the first one of those five. They always come in a standard sequence. And in Buddhism, nothing is really random. Sequences are there for a purpose. Everything is structured according to a certain system. You will notice that at the very first beginning of the Buddha's teaching career, he started out by spending a lot of time by himself, reflecting on the teachings, reflecting on the Dhamma. And I think a lot of the things that he did at that time was to structure his teachings in a way that was very... a kind of the most obvious way of kind of understanding these teachings. And the Buddha says later on that his teachings are svakato, yeah. One of the kind of standard things when we chant about the Dhamma, we say it's svakato. And svakato means well proclaimed, yeah. It is not, nothing is kind of, no expression is extra, nothing is left out. Everything is purposeful in one way or another. And this is a very useful thing to keep in mind, because it means that when you read the suttas, you always notice the structures, you notice the sequences, you try to understand why it is done in a certain way. So this is like a principle, if you like, for interpreting the suttas and getting it right, to understand this, the sequences. And that is true also for the five hindrances. The pancha nivarana. Nivarana means obstruction or hindrance. Pancha is five. And because kamachanda is the first one, that is the main thing. And a lot of the other hindrances are a consequence of kamachanda. Yeah, so, for example, if you are tired and lethargic, very often it's because the mind has been kind of messing around too much in the five-sense world, thinking too much about it. It is tired, you have lost your energy and all of these kind of things. Or if you are restless, very often it has to do with the underlying desires. Yeah, the mind running around in that five-sense world. If you have doubt, doubt can very often be about refined aspects of karma chanda. You don't really know whether it's a problem or not because it is very refined. And even the idea of ill will or vyapada is often a result of karma chanda. Yeah, if the things don't turn out in the five sense world the way you want them to turn out, it's very easy for that to turn into upset and ill will and anger. And when things get thwarted in that world, again, you become angry and upset because things don't turn out the right way. A lot of ill will comes from that. There's also, of course, the sense of self. That's the other kind of cause of defilements. But kamachanda is by far the most difficult one and problematic one. And that's why we have seen before how kamachanda is like a swamp. Yeah, it's kind of, you're stuck in it, it's really hard to get out. It's like a snare. It traps you in that world. And so it is considered like the one of the big things that we have to try to understand. And that's why the focus on this retreat, because this is a meditation retreat, and these are the hindrances specifically to meditation that stops you from achieving real samadhi and all of these kind of things. So if you're able to reflect on these things and kind of let go of them a little bit, it's going to be very beneficial for your meditation. But again, like I said before, be careful not to take it too far, because it's important. Everyone, we all need happiness in our life, joy in our life. And if the path of meditation is not going so well, then you have to have some other kind of happiness. That happiness is the happiness of the five senses. You need to balance these things out. Increase the spiritual happiness, and you can let go more of the sensory happiness. And these things kind of follow each other in a natural sequence like that. Now, having looked at the two kinds of thought, we're going to look at the next sutta, which is called With the Householder Tapusa. This is from the Numerical Discourses, chapter 9th chapter on 9, sutta number 41. And tapusa, not entirely sure who that is. It could be that maybe this is the one of the people who became the first disciples of the Buddha. If you know the story of the people who became the first disciples, they were called Tapusa and Ballika. It's one of those trick questions. If you ever get a question on one of these difficult kind of Dhamma quizzes, they will ask you who were the first disciples of the Buddha, and nobody knows. Actually, maybe if you had grown up in a kind of Buddhist country, and you kind of went to Dhamma school, and you have a really good memory, remember back to, you know, maybe you can remember these things. But it's actually very kind of one of those things that is not very well known. So maybe this is the first disciple coming back after a long time and sort of trying to figure out a bit more about the spiritual life. I don't know, maybe it's just a random guess, but regardless, let's see what happens in this particular sutta. So at one time, the Buddha was staying in the land of the Mallas, near the Malian town named Uruvelakappa. Then the Buddha robed up in the morning, and taking his bowl and robe, entered Uruvelakappa for alms. And after the meal, on his return from alms round, he addressed Venerable Ananda. Ananda, you stay right here while I plunge deep, while I go into the great wood for the day's meditation. So here we have the Buddha staying in the land of the Mallas. The Mallas were the neighboring country to the Sakyans. It was in the on the north bank of the river of the Ganges River, quite far into the country, not too far from Savatthi that we saw before. And this was one of the towns, Uruvelakappa. I don't think this has been found in archaeological excavations, but the Kapilavastu, which is the capital city of the Sakyans, has been discovered. And then you have the usual kind of standard beginning of a discourse, where the Buddha robes up in the morning and takes his bowl and robe, and he enters Uruvelakappa for alms. And again, this, I don't know, I find this very inspiring and interesting. Here is the Buddha, here is this incredible spiritual master who is the leader of this large Buddhist community. And he doesn't just kind of sit in his cutie or wait in the forest. He also enters the town for alms, right, like everyone else. He's just one of the monks, really, and he partakes in the ordinary daily activities of the monastics. It's kind of inspiring. There's no sense of entitlement or sense of being different or sense of being above everything else. No, you're part of the community, and you act as if you're part of the community. And I don't know, how would you feel if you were kind of sitting in your little village? I don't know what your village is, Serpentine, your local village, and then you're kind of waiting, and you're waiting for the monks to come around with their bowls, and then the Buddha comes, right, to receive alms. I mean, this tells you something about how our attitude towards the Buddha has changed, right, over the years. Just the idea of the Buddha coming to receive alms, it just seems strange. How can the Buddha come and receive alms? And if the Buddha came, you'd probably freak out. You think, what do I do now? Bring some special food. Have we got whatever. It's kind of it's kind of strange. Even the thought is kind of strange. And that is because we are so psychologically separated from the Buddha. It's as if the Buddha has become something else. It has been othered into something very special and unique. And it's very hard to think of the Buddha just like an ordinary monk. But that is how he behaves. Yeah. And when he went into the village, the people may not even have recognized the Buddha. They thought, oh, yeah, another monk. Yeah, and they put a bit of food in his bowl. And kind of he walks on. Some probably would recognize him. And it just says something about our mentality in the present day is changed compared to what it was then. And we need to bring it back into reality again. Yeah, the Buddha was really another person. And he behaved like other people, like other monastics at that time. And there wasn't that great distinction between the Buddha and other monastics. And there are occasions when people would mistake. Yeah, they would think it was someone else, and actually turns out to be the Buddha. They wouldn't really be able to tell the difference. And again, this idea that there wasn't that great distinction there. The Buddha was not three times the height of an ordinary person, right? If he was, he would know straight away who the Buddha was, right? If he's three times the height, he would kind of crash his head into the ceiling over here, which is would be noticeable. You would think, oh yeah, there's something special about this person. But it wasn't like that. The Buddha was just, he looked like every other monk, pretty much. And so again, little things like this, to my mind, are really telling, and they say something about our attitude and what it really should be like. And once we do think of the Buddha in this way, once we start to respect and esteem the Buddha in the right way for the qualities that had, the fact that he was able to perfect his human condition, that is when we start to get things right. That's when we can start to have a relationship with the Buddha. That's when we can bow down to the Buddha for the right reasons. That's when we can have the right kind of joy in connection with the Buddha, because we understand who the Buddha really was. So this actually matters. And this has to do with the idea of the Buddha Nusati. Buddha Nusati, the recollection of the Buddha, understanding who he really was. One of the foundations, the basis for giving rise to joy in the meditation practice. Taking that joy with you into your mindfulness of breathing, and then building up the meditation as a consequence. Because joy is so important in meditation. Without the joy, there is no attainment of samadhi. The whole thing just stops. So this ability to do this matters enormously. So then they have their meal, and sometimes they would have the meal maybe in that town, Uruvelakappa, probably just a small town, maybe a few thousand people, something like that. Things were very small scale in those days. Just excuse me a little bit. So they might have the alms food there in the town. And then he addresses Venerable Ananda and he says, stay here, I will go into the great wood. I will plunge into the deep into the great wood. I'm not sure if anyone would actually say something like that, but it's a nice kind of idea. For the day's meditation, this is sometimes translated as the day's abiding, and you will abide in the forest. The Pali word is viharati. Viharati is a word which literally means to dwell, but this word to dwell often means meditation in the suttas. This is how monastic dwells, they dwell in meditation. And one of the typical meditations of the Buddha after the meal is what is called the Mahakaruna. Mahakaruna is the great compassion, where the Buddha surveys the world and he has compassion for everyone. And this becomes the motivating force that then drives the Buddha on his activities, teaching activities, and teaching humanity about the real happiness, not the kind of fake happiness that most people are going after. It's a bad idea to go after fake happiness. It's even worse than fake news. Fake news is bad enough. Fake happiness, well, that's really problematic. This is what the Buddha does. And Venerable Ananda says, yes, sir. And then the Buddha plunged deep into the great wood, the Mahavana, and sat down at the root or the foot of a tree for the day's meditation. You can imagine the Buddha sitting in the forest at the foot of a tree here. And then the householder Tapusa went up to Venerable Ananda, bowed, sat down to one side, and said to him, "Sir Ananda, we are lay people who enjoy sensual pleasures." So, okay, let me just read the whole paragraph. "We like sensual pleasures, we love them and take joy in them, but renunciation seems like an abyss. I have heard that in this teaching and training there are young mendicants whose minds are eager for renunciation. They are confident, settled, and decided about it. They see it as peaceful. Renunciation is the dividing line between the multitude and the mendicants in this teaching and training." So this is kind of interesting. And we lay people, we enjoy sensual pleasures. The Pali word for sensual pleasure is kama, not kamma, but kama. Yeah, kamma and karma are two different words. Kamma is action, karma is sensual pleasures. Or actually, what karma really is, it is the five senses. It's the world of the five senses. So when he says that we enjoy sensual pleasures, what he's really saying is that we enjoy the world of the five senses. Yeah, this thing that we are always part of, that we are always stuck in, that we are part from the moment you wake up in the morning to the time you go at night to bed at night, you are stuck in the world of the five senses. It's extraordinarily, we are kind of immersed in it. Yeah, and this is why it is so hard to get out of it. And you enjoy that world. Yeah, you try to make the most of it, see nice sights, feel, hear nice sounds, feel nice touches, etc. Taste nice tastes. Yeah, this is one of the things you get on the retreat like this. This is one of the main sensual pleasures that remain on this kind of retreat, is the food. Yeah, so make sure you enjoy your food. Are you enjoying your food? Yeah. Anyone not enjoying the food? You don't have to answer that question. It's not, Ajahn Brahm always says that when he starts the retreat, he says there's only two things that are compulsory on this retreat. Yeah, it's not the Dhamma talk, it's not the meditation, it's not getting up at 4 a.m. Two things are breakfast and lunch. Yeah, they are compulsory on the retreat. And I kind of like that idea because it sets the tone for kind of a relaxed retreat. Yeah, even if you just come for breakfast and lunch, don't come for anything else. Yeah, at least come for 10 minutes of... It's okay. The idea of a meditation retreat is to have a good time, is to kind of enjoy yourself and relax. And it doesn't really, it's not about how many hours you meditate or how many talks you listen to. It's about whether you enjoy yourself. That is really the purpose. And however you do that, that is the right way forward. So there's no kind of, we think that we're missing out if we don't do many hours of meditation. But it really depends on what happens in that meditation, whether you're missing out or not. Sometimes you're missing out by not staying in bed, right? Because staying in bed, at least you can relax. Meditation, if it's not working for you, it may just be torture. So sometimes you kind of get these things the wrong way around. But anyway, the five sense world, that is what is meant by karma in Buddhism. Not kamma, but karma. Yeah, so enjoying this, and that's why it's called sensual pleasures very often. It's not a very good translation, but it's the immersion in that five-sense world. That's what it really is about. And this layperson, he just says it as it is. Yeah, we enjoy that five-sense world. We like the sensual pleasures. We love and take joy in them. So he is very kind of upfront about what life is all about for him, at least. But of course, because you love that five-sense world so much, then renunciation seems like an abyss. Yeah, it seems like you're walking off a cliff. It seems like the worst kind of thing, because what you are renouncing, you're renouncing all your happiness. Yeah, and by renouncing all your happiness, life becomes meaningless. And life being meaningless is a bit like an abyss. Pointless. It's like crazy. It's mad, only for mad people to renounce all of the pleasures of life. And this, of course, is a big problem in general. Yeah, the idea that you give something up to be able to give something up, you need something else. So when we talk about renunciation in Buddhism, this word nekamma is the word that is used here. It doesn't just mean giving something up. It means achieving something else in place of what you're giving up. And we'll see in a second how that works. Yeah, it is not just giving up, it's actually much more than that. And then he says, I have heard that in this teaching and training, this is the Dhamma Vinaya, there are very young mendicants whose minds are eager for renunciation. Right? So there are all of these young people. And of course, the idea here is that when you're young, that is when you kind of indulge the most in sensual pleasures. Yeah, this is kind of the idea behind this. But in this teaching and training, in other words, in this spiritual path of the Buddha, Dhamma Vinaya, teaching is the Dhamma, Vinaya is the training that you do as a consequence of that teaching. They are eager for renunciation. They are confident, settled, and decided about it. And this sequence here of words, confident, settled, and decided about it, this is a standard way that the suttas describes the mind, when the mind kind of enters a state of meditation. So you will see this, for example, when you come to the formula for the jhanas, the way that the jhanas are attained is because the mind is confident, settled, and decided about those jhanas. One of the words here is vimuchati. Vimuchati is like released. Yeah, it's like the mind is released as it enters the jhanas. So the jhanas are a release from something, and that release is what that entry into the jhanas are about. So when we see these words right here in relation to renunciation, you are settled, you are confident, you are decided about renunciation. You are liberated through renunciation. Because these are words that are almost always used about the jhanas, you can take it that that is also the meaning here. Renunciation really means the attainment of samadhi. It specifically refers to the attainment of jhana states. So what you are renouncing is really the dukkha. Yeah, this is kind of the weird thing. What we're renouncing is the lower things in the world. You're giving up something that isn't really worthwhile holding on to anyway. You're not giving up anything. It's like giving up, I don't know, what is really bad in this world? It's like giving up McDonald's for going to a 5-star French restaurant or something like that. Yeah, what are you giving up? You're giving up nothing. You're gaining something. That's kind of the point. Or it's like giving up your little shack of a house, yeah, little kind of tin shack with one room, and it's really hot in the summer and cold in the winter. And that kind of, like some of the cuties I put in Anna Monastery, they used to be like that. I don't know how Ajahn Brahm survived. Ajahn Brahm is the toughest person in the world. He lived in this half water tank in the monastery here. Have you seen Ajahn Brahm's old cutie in Bodhidharma Monastery? There's a picture of it in one of the books. It's like a water tank. It's cut in half and then put on the side, so it kind of forms a half circle. Yeah, and then Ajahn Brahm made kind of a wall on one end, a wall on the other end, had a window in it, had a door in it. And then he would live in this half water tank. Yeah, no insulation, just a kind of tin roof. And in the summer, it was 40 degrees outside. It would be even hotter inside. Yeah, in the winter, it would be 5 degrees in the morning outside, and inside it would be exactly the same temperature, 5 degrees inside. And then the rainy season would come. And when the rainy season came, because Ajahn Brahm, he made one big mistake, and he built this kuti in like a little valley, right at the bottom of the valley. And that is where the stream comes. The rainy season comes, the stream comes. And Ajahn Brahm would wake up in the morning after raining all night, and there would be stream coming through his kuti, and his mattress would be right there. And he said, whenever he moved on this mattress, water would come out of the mattress. Yeah, we press on one side, the water comes out. And he was, of course, he was very happy like that. Yeah, that was fine. You just lie still, and then when you lie still, the water doesn't come up, so it's okay. Yeah. This is Ajahn Brahm for you. Yeah. He's like the toughest monk. You probably wouldn't even know this kind of thing, because when you see him now, you kind of it's hard to really imagine, but he is like super duper tough. And I am glad that I came 20 years after the monastery was, 10 years after the monastery was established. I got a nice cutie, etc. But actually, even when I came to the monastery, there were no heaters in the cuties. So it was sometimes very, very cold in those cuties. And there was no escape from the cold, right? Your cold is cold all the time. Even then, it was a little bit tough, but nowhere near what it was like in the early days. I'm not sure how I got to all of that, but basically the idea here is that you give all of these things up. That whole world doesn't really matter anymore. You decide on the renunciation, you enter these jhana states instead, and that is what renunciation really is about. Yeah, you give up that whole world of the five senses, and then you end up in the jhana state. Nothing really that you're giving up. What you're giving up is something like, is like a small shack of a house, and you move into a mansion instead, right? What have you given up? Nothing really. And this is kind of the point. So when you hear the word renunciation, it may sound very forbidding and scary or whatever, but actually the reality is that actually no, you're just gaining something greater, and that is the whole point. And this is why it is worthwhile talking about the five sense world in great detail, because the whole purpose is to kind of guide the mind to higher ground, to a more elevated reality. And the only way to do that is to kind of to contemplate these things in the right way. Okay, so, and they see that as peaceful. Yeah, they see the jhana states as peaceful when you give up all the five senses that are always moving, always craving, always leading to restlessness and problems. And then he says, renunciation is the dividing line between the multitude, Mahajana, I think, and the mendicants in this teaching and training. Yeah, the multitude being the ordinary lay people who don't practice any meditation, and then the mendicants who presumably practice meditation. This is the dividing line. And then Ananda says, householder, we should see the Buddha about this matter. Come, let's go to the Buddha and inform him about this. As he answers, so we will remember it. Yes, sir, replied Tapusa. Then Ananda, together with Tapusa, went to the Buddha, bowed, sat down to one side. Ananda told him what had happened. And the Buddha replies, that is so true, Ananda, that is so true. Before my awakening, when I was still unawakened, but intent on awakening, I too thought renunciation is good, seclusion is good. But my mind wasn't eager for renunciation. It wasn't confident, settled, and decided about it. I didn't see it as peaceful. Then I thought, what is the cause? What is the reason why my mind isn't eager for renunciation and not confident, settled, and decided about it? Why don't I see it as peaceful? Then I thought, I haven't seen the drawbacks of sensual pleasures, and so I haven't cultivated that. I haven't realized the benefits of renunciation, and so I haven't developed that. That is why my mind isn't eager for renunciation, not confident, settled, and decided about it. And that is why I don't see it as peaceful. Again, this sutta is about the Buddha to be. This is what this retreat is like about, the practice of the Buddha to be. And so before his awakening, and again, you can see the Buddha to be has exactly the same problems as most meditators have. Having an idea that renouncing is good, an idea that seclusion is good, but then not really having the full confidence in this yet. Now, it is worthwhile pointing out here that renunciation and seclusion are here kind of two sides of the same coin. Yeah, renunciation is good, seclusion is good. And the idea, of course, is that when you renounce and when you are secluded, these are basically two sides of the same thing. When you come here to Jhana Grove, you are more secluded and you are renouncing more when you come here. It's not... And it's not too bad, right? It's actually quite nice, isn't it? You are giving up many things of your ordinary life, and you are a bit more secluded because you are staying in your own room, going away from your ordinary comforts or whatever. So seclusion and renunciation always go hand in hand. They're two parts, so two aspects of the same thing. Of course, seclusion, first of all, means the seclusion of the body, taking the body into seclusion, and then the mind becomes secluded as a consequence after a while, and that is the real renunciation that happens within. So one thing leading to something else. This word seclusion, or the idea of seclusion, is expressed in different ways in the suttas. But once you start reading the suttas, you start to see it almost everywhere. It pops up here and there in different guises, in different ways, different vocabulary, different contexts with different people. And you start to realize that some of these words are extraordinarily important, and they matter enormously. It's kind of a, I don't know, you notice sometimes how blinkered you are, how biased we are in almost everything we do. It is impossible not to be biased. We will always be biased in one way or another because of our conditioning, because of our background, whatever it is. And I can see that when I read the suttas. I read the suttas in a certain way because I've been conditioned in a certain way. But then after a while, because you are used to reading them, sometimes you discover things you haven't seen before. And suddenly you recognize, actually, this word seclusion, I haven't really paid much notice to this. And once you pay notice to it, it's everywhere. It's kind of strange how life is like that. It's like a word that you haven't heard before, because English, there's always new words to be learned in the English language. And then you come across a word, and suddenly, once you come across it once, you start to see it all over the place. I don't know if you noticed that. It's just kind of the way our mind works. This is a kind of very important lesson for us, because what it means that when you read the suttas, we try to understand the word of the Buddha, you have to be very careful. You have to look very carefully, because it is the bias is always there, and the bias will tend you in a certain direction. And that bias is what leads to, I talked about how important happiness is beforehand on the Buddhist path. And that bias is what leads you to think that happiness is not important, that happiness is dangerous or whatever, that you should avoid samadhi. The only explanation for why this is a common idea in Buddhist circles is because of bias. Because once you start to read the suttas, it's everywhere. It's obviously a fundamental part of the teachings. And yet somehow it has become understood in the Buddhist world that actually it doesn't really matter. It takes a lot of open-mindedness to read the suttas in the right way. And here we find this word seclusion, and it is actually very significant in the sutta, surprisingly so. The Buddha-to-be, he understands the importance of these things, but he is not eager for renunciation, not confident, settled, and decided about it. In other words, he's not really able to enter the jhana states yet. That's what this really means. Then he asks, and this is always how the Buddha-to-be inquires. He always inquires, whenever there's a problem, what is the cause? What is the reason why my mind is lacking this eagerness, lacking the confidence, the settledness, and the decision about this? This is always the inquiry that the Buddha does, Buddha-to-be does. And then he thinks, and this is kind of the power of the Buddha, he sees that he hasn't seen the drawback yet of the five sense world. He hasn't cultivated that drawback. He haven't realized the benefit of renunciation, and haven't developed that benefit. Again, it's about when we don't see sufficiently the drawback of the five sense world, that is the main obstacle in meditation practice. This is the thing that stops you. And as I mentioned before, it can be very strange. You may feel that you are doing quite well, that you are peaceful, maybe you're getting a bit of joy or whatever, but then you kind of plateau. It doesn't go any deeper. It sort of stops in a way. And of course, the question is, well, why does it stop? And very often, if you try to look into your mind and try to understand, you cannot find any obvious reason. Because you feel quite content, you feel quite happy, things are going quite well. Why doesn't it go deeper? What's going on? And the reason you can't see it is because it is very subtle. And that is where it is very useful to have the suttas to give you some guidance on where to investigate, where to look. And very often the answer will be because you're holding on to something. The mind is still not willing to let go. And that inability to let go is very, very hard to see sometimes. So, for example, you may have an attachment to the body. You may have an attachment to the five senses, right? Sometimes people, they start losing the feeling of the body and they freak out a little bit. What's happening to my body? It's not here anymore. And they kind of become a little bit afraid. Actually, once you get used to it, not feeling the body is wonderful because the body is terrible. Yeah, it's full of pains and aches and always wants to be moved around and it's really a massive distraction. So once you get used to it, you see the problem. But in the meantime, while you are on the way to letting go of these things, actually you will find resistance in the mind because this is like your home territory, the five senses. This is where you hang out. This is your world. This is what belongs to you. And giving it up is actually very, very hard. And one of the things about entering a deep state of samadhi is that you're not just giving up like the, you know, seeing certain things or hearing certain things. But when you enter samadhi, it is like you're cut off the five senses completely. It's almost like you're going voluntarily blind, going voluntarily deaf. Yeah. In other words, you really have to understand the downsides of that world, because to the point where you're willing to give up the five senses completely. And the reason for that is because a state of samadhi, there is no access to these five senses. Yeah, you cannot go back. There's no ability to will the re-arising of the five senses. They are gone for a certain amount of time. And this is why you can start to see why insight, why understanding this world in the right way is so important. Otherwise, there's no way you're going to be able to give it up in this way. So you have to give it up completely. Actually, who cares about seeing? Yeah, just more of the same stuff. Yeah, I've seen it all before. Who needs to see it again? Who needs to travel around the world and see all of these sights? Yeah, whatever it might be. And you start to realize, actually, that world is just basically more of the same. Yeah, there's kind of variations on the theme. You heard some music, you've heard all music. Well, maybe that's not quite, you know, maybe that's exactly, some music is definitely not worth hearing. But you get the idea, right? There is only so much you can find in that world. And we are always looking for, like Ajahn Chah famously said, the turtle with the mustache. There are no turtles with mustaches, right? You know that, I hope. If you don't know that, then we have a problem with the communication here. But there are no turtle with mustaches. So when you're looking for a turtle with a mustache, you're looking for the impossible. That's kind of the point. And we are running around in the world, traveling here, traveling there, trying different kinds of food, listening to different kinds of music, seeing different sights, trying to find satisfaction in the world that can never deliver that satisfaction. And there comes a point when you realize everything in that five sense world is just more variations on the same theme, the same things. There's nothing really to be found in that world. And then you're kind of willing to give it up. It is just disturbing. It is just restless. It is always agitated. It is out of control. It always lets you down. That is how you start to think about that five sense world. Then you're able to let go because you see the drawbacks. And of course, the place you go is far superior to whatever you had in that five sense world. And this is the beauty of this path. Always going to something higher, going to something better, letting go of the junk, letting go of the rotten stuff, the stuff that actually is not all that interesting. This is what this path is about. So it's very interesting, yeah. Let go of the rubbish, grasp hold of the diamonds and the gold instead. You think you have gold, but then one day you look at your gold, it turned out to be rubbish. You chuck it out, and then you get hold of the real gold, the real diamonds. And this, of course, is what the spiritual practice is about. We are deluded. We think we have diamonds when we have rubbish. Anyway, just making it up as I go along, but there you are. Okay. So this is how you then reflect, and then you reflect on the benefits of renunciation. And what are the benefits of renunciation? Well, they are the fact that you are attaining the jhana states. Yeah, you're attaining things that will lead to insight, that will take you all the way to awakening down the track. This was one of the insights of the Buddha to be before his awakening, was the understanding that this samadhi, this is what leads to awakening. Yeah, so now you are in the territory, you are in the neighborhood of awakening itself. And that is kind of the great benefits of this renunciation, quite apart from all the happiness it brings, quite apart from all the meaning it gives. Gives a very, very profound sense of meaning, these kind of states. It is as if you feel that you are touching the meaning of life itself. This is really what these states are about. Okay, so then the Buddha says, then I thought, suppose that seeing the drawbacks in sensual pleasures, I were to cultivate that, and suppose that realizing the benefits of renunciation, I were to develop that. It is possible that my mind would be eager for renunciation. It would be confident, settled, and decided about it, and it would see it as peaceful. And so, after some time, I saw the drawbacks of sensual pleasures of the five sense world and cultivated that. And I realized the benefits of renunciation and developed that. Then my mind was eager for renunciation. It was confident, settled, and decided about it. I saw it as peaceful. And so, quite secluded from the five sense world, secluded from unwholesome qualities, I entered and remained in the first jhana, the first absorption, which has the rapture and bliss born of seclusion again, while placing the mind and keeping it connected. So you enter the first jhana based on that renunciation. That is the result of renunciation. The result of seclusion is the ability to attain the deep samadhis on the path. While I was in that meditation, perceptions and attentions accompanied by sensual pleasures beset me, and that was an affliction for me. Suppose a happy person were to experience pain, that would be an affliction for them. In the same way, when perception attentions accompanied by the five senses beset me, that was an affliction for me. So now, because you have attained something so peaceful, so powerful, when the five senses kind of start to re-arise and reappear after being in the jhana for a while, they feel like an affliction, they feel like an illness, they feel like pain. And this is kind of now is what you understand, what these things really are about. After emerging from a jhana like this, you have the full understanding of the problem of the five senses. They are a pain. That is what the Buddha is saying here. Kind of fascinating, isn't it? The things in the world that we take to be so important, the things in the world that we cling on to, hold on to for dear life. Why? Because we want to see, we want to hear all of these kind of things. After a deeper state of samadhi, all of that, that entire world seems like a pain to you. Why? Because you have seen an alternative far more profound, far more beautiful, far more peaceful, far more happy, far more meaningful than anything you ever had in your life before. And this is what you see here. It's extraordinary, isn't it? But and just reading about it is kind of joy-inducing, yeah? Because you cannot really help but believe it. This is the Buddha saying these things. We know that there are people seeing these things in the present day. It's just reading about this kind of lifts you up and inspires you, and it reminds you of what really is at stake in this life. What is possible, what can be done by giving up things that apparently seem very important to us, but actually turn out to be rubbish when you start to look at them more carefully. This is what the promise of the Buddha here. This is the promise of having right view. Looking at the world in the right way. Thinking, understanding what really is valuable and what is not. That is what is going on here. And I don't know about you, but just reading about this makes me feel inspired. Yeah, it's just there's something very... It draws you in. It's the power of the word of the Buddha. You cannot really help but feel that there's something really interesting going on here. And this, of course, is exactly what it is. There is something very interesting going on. And Then there is a whole paragraph more, and this next paragraph, I might as well read it out, well, because it is here anyway. I thought I was going to skip it, but let's read it out. Then I thought, why don't I, as the placing of the mind and keeping it connected are still the enter and remain in the second jhana, the second absorption. But my mind wasn't eager to stop placing the mind. It wasn't confident, settled, and decided about it. I didn't see it as peaceful. Then I thought, what is the cause? What is the reason why my mind isn't eager to stop placing the mind, not confident and settled about it? Why don't I see it as peaceful? So placing the mind is the word vitakka. Vitakka is like the movement of the mind onto the object, and this refers to kind of the little bit of wobble that you have in the first jhana experience. And then I thought, I haven't seen the drawbacks of placing the mind, and so I haven't cultivated that. I haven't realized the benefits of not placing the mind, and so I haven't developed that. That is why my mind isn't eager to stop placing the mind, and not confident, settled, and decided about it. And it's why I don't see it as peaceful. Then I thought, suppose that seeing the drawbacks of placing the mind, I were to cultivate that. And suppose that realizing the benefits of not placing the mind, I were to develop that. It's possible that my mind would be eager to stop placing the mind. It would be confident, settled, and decided about it. It would see it as peaceful. And so after some time, I saw the drawbacks of placing the mind and cultivated that. I realized the benefits of not placing the mind, and I developed that. Then my mind was eager to stop placing the mind. It was confident, settled, and decided about it. I saw it as peaceful. And so, as the placing of the mind and keeping it connected was stilled, I entered and remained in the second jhana. Yeah. So now you go even one step deeper, stage by stage deeper. And while I was in that meditation, perception and attentions accompanied by placing the mind beset me, and that was an affliction for me. Suppose that a happy person were to experience pain, that would be an affliction for them. In the same way, when perception and attentions accompanied by placing the mind and keeping it connected beset me, that was an affliction for me. So the idea here is that once you go deeper, then the previous state seems like painful by comparison. Yeah, you go. This is how you go deeper and deeper and deeper. But the main point here that I'm kind of trying to make is that just the get to the first jhana first of all. This is already takes already a lot of commitment to get there, and that is kind of the main issue at stake here. But then, of course, it goes even further. Then I thought, why don't I, with the fading away of rapture, enter and remain in the third absorption, where I will meditate with equanimity, mindfulness, and awareness, personally experiencing the bliss of which the noble ones declare. Equanimous and mindful, one meditates in bliss. And then he carries on, but my mind wasn't eager, etc., and then he carries on like this, yeah, keeps on going through all the jhanas and eventually going all the way to awakening itself. But the main point for now is just the right view about the five senses, and that's why I have been reading this out. So there you are, that is the Tapusa Sutta. And I don't know if you approve or not, but there you are anyway, whether you approve or not. It's hard to know sometimes whether to approve of these things without sufficient experience. But it is always inspiring just to read the word of the Buddha and to kind of get a feeling for how he presents these things. We have a few minutes left, so I'm going to start the next sutta as well. And this is, now we're going back to the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length sayings of the Buddha, and this is the shorter discourse on the mass of suffering. And again, it is really concerned about the five senses and sensual pleasures and having the right view about these things. Yeah, this is kind of the last sutta about the five senses and sensual pleasures, and maybe some of you will be relieved to hear that. Now we kind of we heard enough about the downside of the five senses. But anyway. So let's see what this sutta has to say here. So I have heard. At one time the Buddha was staying in the land of the Sakyans near Kapilavatthu in the Banyan Tree Monastery. So the land of the Sakyans, of course, is the land of the Buddha, where the Buddha came from. This is his kind of his family and his clan. And the main city or the main town there was Kapilavatthu or Kapilavastu, which is has been discovered through archaeological digs. Yeah, so these are real places, not just found in the suttas. They exist. And the main monastery there was called the Banyan Tree Monastery. The Nigrodharma is the place that he was staying in. Then Mahanama the Sakyan went up to the Buddha, bowed, sat down to one side, and said to him, "For a long time, sir, I have understood your teaching like this. Greed, hate, and delusion are corruptions of the mind. Despite understanding this, sometimes my mind is occupied by thoughts of greed, hate, and delusion. I wonder what qualities remain in me that I have such thoughts." Yeah, so this is again very interesting. He's really inquiring. You will notice how in those days people were quite inquiring. Yeah, they would ask the Buddha, they would ask the monks questions about all kinds of things. They would like have discussions about things, conversations about those things. This was like the acceptable way of doing things. The idea is not that, if you are a monastic, then you should just listen and you should remain quiet. And this is sometimes what happens in certain situations in the present day, but that is not really the right way. It is about having a conversation, gaining a deeper understanding through inquiry. That is the right way. And you see this throughout the suttas. And Mahanama here, he was a cousin of the Buddha. He was a brother of the famous monk Anuruddha, Mahanama and Anuruddha. And so he goes then to the Buddha, to his clansman, if you like, his fellow, his cousin, and he asked this beautiful question. "For a long time I have understood your teaching like this." You can take it that when he says that he has understood the teaching like this, greed, hate, and illusions are corruptions of the mind, that could be an indication that he is a stream mentor at least, this is kind of sometimes how this is described. You have a full understanding of the nature of the mind, and so he might be a stream mentor at this point. So this is kind of what he's saying here. But despite having this insight that the minds are occupied by these things, even though you understand that these are a problem, still they come, still they invade the mind. So what is going on here? If you understand that something is a problem, why do these things invade the mind? Before I answer that, I will just tell you the nice little story of Mahanama and Anuruddha. Do you know the story of Mahanama and Anuruddha? Okay, you don't. Okay, no one is raising the hand. Okay, so I'm gonna tell you the story of Mahanama and Anuruddha, because you had the chance to stop me, but you didn't take it. Just a warning. So Mahanama and Anuruddha, they were two brothers. And they were kind of living with a kind of larger family, and they would kind of cultivate the fields and all of these kind of things. And as they were doing this, the Buddha would come and visit their town. The Buddha was their cousin, and when the Buddha came to visit, all of the Sakyans, the family of the Buddha, many, many people would go forth. They were really inspired by their cousin, the Buddha, who was kind of really impressive person. And so many people, almost every family, had someone who went forth. In those days, families were often very large, so it was, I don't know how many children, often had lots and lots of children, and so if one went forth, it was kind of okay. These days, it's kind of more traumatic if one goes forth, because it might be your only child. Then it's a bit more difficult. And so then there is the family of Mahanama and Anuruddha, and they kind of, Mahanama thinks, well, all the other families, they have someone gone forth, but in our family, no one has gone forth. Either Anuruddha or I should go forth. So kind of to do the right thing, so to speak. And so Mahanama, he goes to Anuruddha and he says to Anuruddha, well, Anuruddha, one of us should go forth, because this is what all the other families do. And then Aniruddha says, well, you know, I have been brought up in so with so great comfort, and just always been looked after. I can't, there's no way that I'm able to go forth because I'm so addicted to luxury and kind of the nice things in life. Absolutely forget it. You go forth. This is kind of Aniruddha for you. And Aniruddha was famous. It's a famous story of the nutty cakes. Ajahn Brahm sometimes tells the story of the nutty cakes. The nutty cake story is the story where Aniruddha, he would always get whatever he wanted. He was completely spoiled rotten, right? This is kind of Aniruddha for you. He also became a great monk, which is kind of interesting here. So just because you're spoiled doesn't mean you can't become a good monk, which is fascinating here. And so he always goes to his mum, oh, you know, I need some cookies, cakes or whatever it is. And then he had always, there will always be some cakes for him, until one day there wasn't any cakes. So his mum says, nutty cake. Nutty means there is no cake. But Aniruddha didn't understand the word nutty. He didn't understand the word there isn't. He had never heard the word there isn't before. What on earth is this word there isn't? So he says, yes, please, I'll have some nutty cakes. This is what he became famous for. I have some of those there isn't any cakes. And so he was very spoiled, and very kind of brought up in great comfort and all of these kind of things. And so he says to Mahanama, you go forth, and I will stay in the household life. And then Mahanama says to him, well, if you're going to stay in the household life, you have to do the duties of a householder. And Aniruddha said, well, what are the duties of a householder? He has never lifted a finger, right? He doesn't know anything about the duties of a householder. And so Mahanama said, well, you know, the duties of a householder are that, you know, when the kind of the season starts in spring, you have to go out and till the fields. And after tilling all the fields, you have to sow the seeds in the fields. And after sowing the seeds, you have to irrigate the fields. You have to let the water into the fields. And after irrigating the fields, you have to drain the fields. And after draining the fields, you have to weed the field. Lots of weeds in between there. And after weeding the fields, then you have to reap the harvest. You have to go out and cut it all down. After reaping the harvest, you have to thrash the harvest to get kind of to separate the corn from all the other stuff, and then you have to winnow it to get rid of all the chaff and all the bad things, and after winnowing it and kind of getting the seeds together, you have to store them for the next season, right? And as soon as you have stored it for the next season begins already. And Aniruddha starts to think, wait a minute, what am I getting myself into? And then Aniruddha said, well, And then what? Isn't there a time for rest, a time where I can just relax and enjoy myself? And then Mahanama says, no, well, you know, then the next season starts. And then he says, well, this is how our fathers and all our forefathers, while doing this work every year, year in, year out, they all died. And then the next generation carried on until they died. And this is how we got to the point where we are now. And then Aniruddha says, well, in that case, I will go forth, you stay in the home life. This was Aniruddha for you. It was a bit of a scallywag. He kind of started to understand the kind of the problems of life. Life is not as easy as you would like it to be. There you are. Just leaving you there with the kind of the idea of who Mahanama was. And then we can contemplate when we come back tomorrow morning. We will look at the rest of this particular sutta. So that is all for now. So please carry on enjoying yourself. And then we'll see you back again at 7 o'clock this evening.